Thanks very much. So when I asked a colleague for advice about how to handle this, the only advice I got was to keep it short. So the title is Inflation and the Primordial Density Perturbation, Some New Ideas. Insofar as it's new, it's been developed with David Wands. But of course, since it's a general audience, I have to spend some time on background. Now, when I go to a talk that I don't understand, which is usually, one problem is this symbol keeps on appearing that the speaker dearly loves. And I sort of feel if I could only understand what the hell this meant, I might understand the talk. So I'll try to be mindful of that. And I sort of counted three symbols that are totally essential. I'll try to avoid that particular problem. So what is inflation? It's inflation and the primordial density perturbation. So I've got to explain what each of those is. What is inflation? First of all, we need the concept of the scale factor of the universe. Suppose we have three galaxies at some particular time. Then a bit later on, a lot later on in fact, this one might have moved down to here. This one might have moved out to here. So they're twice as far apart. The important thing is that all pairs are twice as far apart. So there's the concept of the scale factor of the universe, whose symbol is A. And it's simply the distance apart that any two galaxies are, usually normalized to one at the present time, but there are other choices that could be more convenient. And by the way, I chose one of them to be at rest, but they're all in free fall anyway, because gravity is the only force operating at these big distances, so it doesn't matter which one I choose. Another point is, if I go to the early universe, which is gaseous, there are no galaxies. So this becomes the cloud of gas, which later will become the galaxy. So that's the scale factor.
Can I ask you a question that students and sometimes lay people often ask, especially you give a popular lecture? Does this mean that the room is expanding? Does this mean that the distance
absolutely not,
in
no.
New York is expanding?
I hate this phrase that says space is expanding.
Right.
I mean,
so,
absolutely not.
Absolutely. Right.
There's nothing wrong with the Newtonian description, in my view. Right, so what is inflation? Well, we now believe that if we plot the time derivative of A with respect to time, I've got the origin in the wrong place. What we believe is that there's a period of exponential increase and then slow decrease up to the present and then some more exponential increase. So this is the present. I've still got the origin in the wrong place. So this is what we call inflation. And during inflation, the scale factor increases exponentially with some coefficient that I'm going to call H star. And at the present time, unless there are some surprises, it looks like we're talking about lambda domination, cosmological constant domination, at least for some extended period. So A is again going to increase exponentially, and pretty much that's the present value of the Hubble parameter that we didn't define yet. And then in between we have the hot Big Bang, when the scale factor is proportional to T to the half if it's radiation dominated, or T to the 2/3 if in fact non-relativistic matter is dominating. That is wildly out of scale, obviously, but this is what inflation means. Why is that a big deal? To understand that, we need to define the Hubble parameter, and that's the definition of the Hubble parameter, the Hubble time, h minus 1, at any epoch, is pretty much the age of the universe since the scale factor, since it has expanded appreciably, the age measured from some earlier time when the scale factor was much less. C times that is the Hubble distance, and that's the distance that light can travel during the Hubble time. Now let's consider a co-moving distance, one between two co-moving points, which might be galaxies or, in the early universe, bits of the gas. And let's divide that by the Hubble distance, and then we find that that's proportional to a dot. Now, since the galaxies are in free fall, the a dot decreasing is very easy to understand. That just means that gravity is slowing down the expansion of the universe. The increase corresponds to repulsive gravity, which is allowed by Einstein's GR. When we have attractive gravity, if we go back in time, this scale gets to be out of causal contact. Maybe not in principle, but in a practical way. That is to say, any signal that travels this distance, it couldn't make the journey before the universe expands appreciably. And for practical purposes, that means that the scale is out of causal contact. So we define, when this is equal to 1, we define that as the epoch of horizon entry during the normal hot Big Bang. And the point about this graph is that the same scale was inside the horizon during inflation, if we go early enough. At the present epoch, the entire observable universe, whose size is of order the Hubble distance, is by definition at this moment entering the horizon. And the important point is that at the beginning of inflation, it was supposed to be very far inside the horizon. And so then, unless we believe in a sort of fractal structure of the universe, if we go down to small enough scales, it ought to be homogeneous. So the present universe is homogeneous because it started out as a very small fraction of the total, in some sense. Right. So that's the end of inflation. For the moment, we'll return to inflation. What is the primordial density perturbation? Oh, sorry, it's not the end of inflation. During inflation, massless scalar fields, something very peculiar happens to them. If I've got a massless scalar field, any quantity in the early universe that varies with position, we should decompose it in a Fourier integral. But the label X should be a co-moving position, so that K divided by A is the physical wavelength. Why do we do that? Because on very general principles, the coupled equations that couple all of the modes, different k's will decouple, just like in the non-expanding universe, we do a Fourier series, different wave vectors decouple. Okay, so that defines the phi k. Now, for a massless scalar field during inflation, something very peculiar happens. Horizon exit, of course, is when this... That's true. So horizon exit during inflation That's true. Suppose before horizon exit, we postulate that phi is in the quantum vacuum state, that there are no phi particles. And then we do quantum field theory in curved space-time, and we find that phi k, which actually doesn't depend on time asymptotically, it's a classical quantity. It's not any longer a fluctuation, in the sense that if I were to measure it in some mysterious way, I could do so in such a way that a wave packet in the Schrodinger picture would not spread at future times. But of course, before we do that, it's a quantum object. So what we do is define the spectrum. That in this way, with some k factors that depend on the definition, and with the definition that most of us adopt, that is h over 2 pi squared, and the important thing is it's times a delta function. The different modes are not correlated, and that is the only correlation, only non-trivial correlation, and it's what we call a Gaussian perturbation. It means that that's the only non-trivial correlation. So all of these massless scalar fields acquire this perturbation during inflation.
This just says it's translationally invariant, although it's not correlated.
Yes, it's the fact that triple and higher correlations don't exist, except trivially.
Yeah, but you posit that, do you?
No, it's a consequence of quantum field theory during inflation. If phi is a massless scalar field, it's in Berlin Davis's textbook that was written before inflation.
A free massless field. You posit that it's free.
That is, that's right. Right.
It's a little more than
okay. What do you mean? This is not any particular field yet. I'm just saying that if a field is free and massless, then it will acquire this perturbation. Yeah.
In order for inflation to last long enough, the field, so you could posit that there's a mass term in there. But in order for inflation to last long enough to do all the things that for which it's involved, that mass term has to be very small.
No. Well, yes, but this is not yet the inflaton. It's just any old scalar field.
Okay.
And the important thing is that this does not depend on any particular theory of inflation. It's a kinematic result. It's about the Robertson-Walker universe. It's nothing to do with gravity or slow roll inflation or anything of that nature. Right, so now we've finally left inflation. What is the primordial density perturbation? So the density in the universe, in the early universe, it's gaseous, but its density varies a little bit as we go from place to place. We know that now from observation of the CMB. In any case, we knew it before, because how else could galaxies form unless some bits were more dense than others? So the density, the energy density rho, of course, we can again Fourier expand it. And again, we've got now focusing on the hot Big Bang. We've got horizon entry. This density perturbation exists during the hot Big Bang. The scale comes inside the horizon. Now, if this is a cosmologically interesting scale, horizon entry is quite late by early universe standards. It's after primordial nuclear synthesis. So we know the density, we know the content of the universe pretty much. It's a sum of four components. Cold dark matter or something similar. Baryonic matter, which means ordinary matter. Effectively massless neutrinos and photons. And each of those has a perturbation. And after horizon entry, there are some complicated coupled equations that people know how to solve. The CDM just falls into the more dense places. The baryons and photons are coupled together tightly for a while and they oscillate. The neutrinos free stream away from over dense regions. That's all well known. But well before horizon entry, the situation becomes simple. So while the scale is far outside the horizon, effectively nothing in a way can happen because free streaming, there isn't time for it to happen. The oscillation won't happen. There won't be time for the dark matter to fall into the more dense regions, etc. Now, when we define a perturbation in any kind of physics, we smooth over some scale much less than the size of the perturbation. You know, when we talk about a gas, we smooth over many atomic volumes. And so I'm going to assume we've done that. But the trick is to take the smoothing scale to be much bigger than the Hubble distance. And if we do that, then it's pretty clear that each co-moving world line in the universe just evolves like an unperturbed universe, because the spatial gradients are too small for anything interesting to happen. So we've got this separate universe picture where the evolution along each world line is like in a separate unperturbed universe. Historically, it's not clear to me who first came up with that, but it's absolutely crucial. So now these are non-relativistic, these are matter, these are relativistic. So that means that at each place in the universe, the evolution is like a to the minus 3 for the matter, and then there's an extra factor a to the minus 4 because the radiation is doing work against the pressure as it expands. That's the well-known behavior. Now, this depends on position. It's the locally defined scale factor in general. We now encounter the problem about large-scale perturbations. We've got to choose a slicing of space-time. And in contrast with a situation when the scale is far inside the horizon, it's not obvious which slicing to choose. Give two examples. We might choose the slicing to be orthogonal to the co-moving world lines, and that seems like quite a good choice. Or we might choose the slicing so that the slice is spatially flat, like the background universe, no intrinsic curvature. That choice, David and I have realized sort of recently, is the best one, because it can be shown that in that case, the scale factor is not perturbed. It can be taken to be uniform, and having defined it to be uniform initially, it won't change with time. Now we look at this, that means that the fraction of perturbation in each of those quantities is time independent. So that is the primordial perturbation. That's the second half of the title. So there are four quantities. That must be specified as the initial condition of the universe. And the question is, where do those four quantities come from? What determines them? Okay. I should have said that, you know, comments and questions are clearly welcome. Okay. Now, until David and I drew attention to the opposite possibility, almost everybody made the adiabatic hypothesis. Why it's called adiabatic is sort of lost in the mists of time, but I'll explain what it is. There was an Martin Booker is around somewhere, and he and Neil Turner, Cavillian Moodley, drew attention more strongly than had been the case in the past, a year or two ago, to the fact that that might not be correct, and there might be what are called isocurvature perturbations, which contradict that hypothesis. And I believe in one of their papers they write that this can be realized, the most generous scenario, that is to say where these are all different and generic, can be realized if we have the inference on plus four other fields playing important roles in the early universe. So personally, when I saw that, I thought, well, you know, very unlikely. And what David and I have drawn attention to is that actually we can do it with one field, one additional field in addition to the inflaton, which we call the curvaton. So what is the adiabatic hypothesis? Well, it's simply that each of these separate universes is identical. The evolution of all quantities of interest is just exactly the same. So now we can do the following trick. This is our preferred slicing, but let's choose a different slicing such that the total density, energy density, is constant on this different slicing. Constant in space now on this different, this is a time variable, so this is an instant in time. But I'm choosing to slice the universe in two different ways.
You mean delta rho zero on that slice?
I'm sorry. Thank you, Kate. Yeah. So the density is uniform. So if I do that, and then I make a displacement from that slice to the chosen flat one, then...
there always such a unique slice?
Excuse me? Well, the whole thing, we're talking about a family of, it's a family of slices, so such a family always exists. Now, the thing about this a to the minus 3 or a to the minus 4 is that the logarithmic derivative is simply a constant times the, in fact it's 3 in the case of matter and 4 in the case of radiation. So the perturbation that I pick up when I go to the flat slicing, if I define quantities delta rho I divided by rho I prime, these are going to be the same for I equals CDM baryons, radiation, photons and neutrinos. They all have exactly the same value. And it's conventional to define the isocurvature perturbations in this way, where I is either CDM or baryon or neutrinos. So these are zero according to the adiabatic hypothesis. Again, this term isocurvature perturbation, at this stage I didn't justify, it's just what people call it. So if all of these are zero, and I've only got four perturbations altogether, that only leaves one other quantity to specify, tremendously simplifies things. What should this other quantity be?
I'm sorry, I was under the impression, maybe false, that we actually knew something about the relationship between the gas perturbations and temperature from the CMB very large-scale structure.
Well, I'm coming to that. The CMB is consistent with zero, but it could be like you know, tens of percent in comparison with the other. We do know that that is not the dominant mode. That is correct.
We do know that which is not the dominant mode.
These, if they're not zero, they're in some sense small, according to observation.
Right, so the observations so far are consistent with the adiabatic.
Exactly.
Anything else?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Just checking.
Right. Now, what are we going to choose then as a non-zero quantity? If that's meant to be a zeta, and what we should do is choose it to be that quantity. Why should we do that?
What is rho without an I?
Rho is the total energy density.
Oh.
Yes. Why should we make that particular definition? Well, as indicated, it would then be independent of time under the adiabatic hypothesis. Why is it independent of time? Well, in an unperturbed universe, no energy can flow from one place to another. So the energy changes according to that relation, where V, of course, goes like the cube of the volume. And if we work it out, what that implies for the rate of change of the energy density, what we find is that's good, we're getting on quite fast. We find that rho prime is minus 3 rho plus p. That's a completely general relation, but now we invoke the adiabatic hypothesis, p is just some function of rho, because all of these separate universes are actually identical. So that's some function of rho. And then it's just mathematics that if that's some function of rho, then to first order in the perturbations, that thing is independent of time. Now, in the literature, that's called the curvature perturbation rather than the density perturbation. And that comes from the fact, again, remember that slicing, it can also be interpreted as the spatial curvature of the constant of the uniform rho slices. And that's the more customary interpretation. But in what follows, it's going to be much more useful to regard it as just a density perturbation, which is constant because of the adiabatic hypothesis. So we've reduced the entire problem under the adiabatic hypothesis to understanding one perturbation. Okay, now back to inflation. I need to explain briefly what is slow roll inflation. It's virtually the only model that seems to work for inflation, but it's fairly special. The idea is we have Einstein gravity. And that, of course, defines the energy density. And we've got a scalar field, and that's the well-known expression for the energy density of a scalar field with a given potential. The case I was considering before was for the perturbation in the field, the potential was zero, massless field. And then we've got the equation of motion of the perturbation of the field. This is all in the unperturbed universe. And then we choose the potential to be very flat in some region. And then in the simplest case, it just descends to the vacuum value. And so this is the inflating region. Then after inflation, the field oscillates and decays and produces the hot Big Bang. It's very old and boring, but, you know, with some reservations, nobody has really come up with a better alternative so far. And then, of course, the trick is to use the... we get the adiabatic hypothesis is verified if we then declare that the field responsible for the density perturbation is the inflaton, And it gets the famous h over 2 pi perturbation. And the point is, during inflation, this gives an attractor, that should be an h in there, sorry. This gives a solution which is achieved pretty much independently of the initial conditions, an attractor solution. And that means if I set the clock ticking when phi is uniform, so this is now a uniform phi slice. I don't need to draw any other slice since there's nothing to compare it with. Set the clock ticking on some slice of uniform phi, then all the evolution for all of the universes is going to be identical, because the hypothesis is that no other field, phi is the only field that is cosmologically significant. Okay? So that is the origin of the justification for the adiabatic hypothesis. The only cosmologically significant field is the inflaton. And then we get those results. So the new hypothesis that we made, David and I, well, or we advocated more strongly than before, is the curvaton hypothesis. And according to the curvaton hypothesis, well, we don't really need slow roll inflation, but let's assume it. The perturbation associated with the inflaton field is just negligible. compared with observation. Some other field is what generates the perturbation. We call it sigma, the curvaton. It acquires the vacuum fluctuation during inflation. And so I need to explain in the sort of closing 10 minutes or so, what is the curvaton model and how does it evade the adiabatic hypothesis, making isocurvature perturbations quite sort of natural, relatively natural compared with in the other case. Okay, so what happens in the curvaton model? We've already said the first part. During inflation, sigma acquires the usual perturbation, h over 2 pi. Then the universe reheats, again, perfectly normal. So now we have the hot Big Bang with its radiation and the contribution of the curvaton field, which as yet is negligible. By the way, those people who know about axion cosmology, this is just like the axion, except that it dominates the energy in the early universe and then it decays, whereas the axion is supposed to be dark matter. It doesn't do that. So this is initially of order zero. But at some stage, the mass is supposed to become significant, and that's when the Hubble parameter falls to become less than the mass. Then the mass becomes significant, and the curvaton field then oscillates under its potential. Before that, it was frozen at some value, but now it starts to oscillate, and it generates energy density at each position in space. We're still far outside the horizon at this stage, so we have separate universes. So if sigma is the amplitude of the oscillation, that is the energy density at each point in space. But that's perturbed. So that generates a density perturbation. Which has a linear part, and then it's got a quadratic part. Something I don't have time to emphasize in this talk is that the quadratic part could be big, generating non-Gaussianity. So that's the next thing that happens. Okay.
Do you have in mind that the field has a mass at all times, or is it like an axial field that fires a mass after?
It really doesn't matter. And it will in general vary in the effective mass in any case will in general vary because of the coupling of sigma to other fields, etc. So that's just the very simplest case, I mean.
Because during the equation, you when you calculate the production of perturbations to sigma,
yeah,
you do a linear theory calculation.
Yeah.
And then over here, you're finding contributions to delta rho that are quadratic to delta sigma.
Yeah.
Is it self-consistent to neglect the quadratic terms in delta sigma during inflation?
It's self-consistent when I'm calculating delta sigma. By hypothesis, sigma is sufficiently weakly coupled from other fields. That is the hypothesis. I mean, that potential is just basically zero on the scale of H during inflation. You don't know it's there during inflation, because compared with H, the mass is negligible during inflation. Right, that's the next thing that happens. What happens next in the curvaton model? The curvaton, while it oscillates, now it starts to grow compared with the background radiation density. It finally decays, and the decay products thermalize.
I'm a little confused as to what you're doing. You're postulating some particle with some properties. You're describing the scenario as if we knew what sigma was. Or are you deducing what properties sigma has to have?
Well, we proposed this in October. John March Russell and Yanagida and some other people have already proposed that the curvaton is the right-handed partner, is the scalar partner of the right-handed neutrino, and that it generates neutrino masses by the seesaw mechanism. It generates CDM and baryons through its decay, and it generates the primordial perturbation by this mechanism. I mean, these guys are not completely crazy.
But the fact that it does solve three big problems at the same time makes it more or less likely.
Okay. Maybe I'll just write down the final prediction and that'll be...
I just want to know what sigma is, what its properties are.
What its required properties are. It should be a gauge singlet, otherwise it won't live long enough after it starts to oscillate. Its Yukawa's or whatever coupling should be somewhat suppressed, like 10 to the minus a few. And its mass during inflation should be negligible. Its effective mass, and that's the tricky part. Particles generally get a mass of order H because of various generic interactions. I would say they're the properties.
Is a scalar not a superscalar?
Absolutely irrelevant. No, I would say I was including pseudoscalar under that term, yeah. I think a stringy axion would be a better candidate because this mass of order H is quite worrying that generic supergravity gives. So I'll just finish with the prediction and then that'll probably be enough. Yeah. So the prediction is that zeta, the curvature perturbation, that's why we call it the curvaton, has this form. And R is the fractional amount that the curvaton contributes to the energy density at decay. And zeta sigma is its fractional perturbation at decay. and the whole product has to be of order 10 to the minus 5 to agree with observation, and that can come from R equal to 1 and the perturbation 10 to the minus 5, or in principle R 10 to the minus 5 and the perturbation of order 1. But in the latter case, the non-Gaussianity would already have been observed. So that already constrains the model. What about the isocurvature perturbations? Well, let's just take CDM as an example. Depending on how the CDM is produced, the number density of the CDM particles at creation will just be some function of those two densities. We're not in a one-parameter universe any longer. So there's absolutely no reason for the adiabatic hypothesis to be correct. These things vary independently as we move around in space. So the separate universes are labeled by that pair, and they are different. And so if you tell me how CDM is supposed to be created, then I will do that differentiation, and that will give me SCDM. And the same applies to baryons. And something I didn't have time to go into is the neutrino case. I'll just write down one formula. If I want a neutrino perturbation, then if I want it to be generated in the early universe, I'd better introduce a lepton number. And we figured out a nice formula for the size of the neutrino perturbation that will give. And this is the lepton number density isocurvature perturbation. And it's the same story. If you tell me what is the density of lepton number in the early universe as a function of rho radiation and rho sigma, how is the lepton number created, if it is, then I can give you the perturbation that appears in this formula. So the message is that perturbations are generic, fully correlated, by the way, with the curvature perturbation. There's only one field, and we should try to constrain them observationally. If you want a best guess on grounds of simplicity, well, of course, if baryons, CDM, and leptons are all created after the curvaton decays, then we're back with the original scenario, where there are no isocurvature perturbations, and we live in a one-parameter universe. That's still my best guess personally, but I'm not as convinced as I was a year ago that it would necessarily be the right answer. Okay.
Question? I mean, I'm completely outside it, but how strong are the constraints imposed by an observation on what you're trying to do? I mean, how unique is the theoretical framework that you're working with? Is it?
Which is the question? Observation or the theory? I mean.
Well, no. How constrained by observation is the theory that you're developing?
Some of the parameter space is already ruled out. For example,
field content. I mean, it seems like, I don't know. There's just,
well, I mean, let's take the Yanagida March Russell thing as an example, and let's believe them that it's the scalar partner of the right-handed neutrino. That takes care of the theory. Observation, I was going to say, for example, if the cold dark matter is created significantly before the curvaton decays, then we've got a definite prediction, and it's already ruled out by observation. So the CDM is either created by the curvaton decay or after the curvaton decay. That's an example.
So you can rule out particular theoretical scenarios, but
yes.
But are there an infinite number of other theoretical scenarios that you just haven't explored that cannot?
Well, of course. Of course, it's like field theory beyond the standard model.
Okay. Well, that's why I just want to get a feel for how unconstrained it is completely.
Yeah. I mean, This is an application of field theory beyond the standard model.
Well, remember that the input on is so far a figment.
It's not so straight. You can do an experiment, measurement, and go to AstroPH, and you can plot the number of papers where people talked about topological defects as the origin of density perturbations. And it's a very large number per year until 1999 when the cosmic microwave background results came along. And then it was more or less a Heaviside step function fell to zero.
So things can be ruled out by...
So things have been ruled out. The strange thing about the CMB results is that if inflation is not responsible for density perturbations, then whatever else produces density perturbations has to mimic inflation quite a bit. So what happened back in the old days is that people would measure perturbation amplitude in galaxy surveys, and they'd figure out, you know, what's the difference between the galaxy density in this part of the universe and this part of the universe. And then you run Newton's laws back in time, and you figure out what the density perturbation had to be in the early universe when CMB photons decoupled. That's a small number. And then you assume that if there's a density perturbation at the surface of light scatter, then the cosmic microwave background photon has a temperature fluctuation. So you could predict, given the galaxy density perturbation amplitude, the CMB fluctuation amplitude. Now, there's this strange thing that happens with adiabatic perturbations. If a CMB photon is coming from an overdense region, then there are two effects that happen. First of all, the CMB photon, when it climbs out of the deeper gravitational potential well, gets redshifted. But at the same time, if you have adiabatic perturbations, the gas in that deeper potential well is hotter. And that tends to cancel partly the redshift. So the temperature fluctuation for a fixed density perturbation amplitude is smaller in adiabatic perturbations than you might have guessed naively. So it actually turns out to be one-third the gravitational potential amplitude. Whereas with isocurvature perturbations or topological defects or a lot of other things that people used to think about, the fluctuation amplitude, the CMB temperature fluctuation amplitude is more like two times the gravitational potential, which is six times as big. So the fact that the CMB temperature fluctuation is so small means that adiabatic perturbations are far more reasonable than just about anything else. And this is why such a huge class of alternative structure formation models have been ruled out. And anything else that you make has to be constructed to mimic inflation. So what's going on here, what Dave was talking about, is a model which is sort of a correction to the lowest order naivist inflation model, which has only one scalar field, produces only adiabatic perturbations. And David's starting with a constraint that whatever deviation he has from the standard or the simplest model has to be very small.
Well, I don't know, 20-30% or something, depending how you measure them.
It can't be the dominant component.
No. For example, CDM in this model, the measurement is it's got to be less than 1.5 times the curvature perturbation, for example. I mean, I wouldn't call that negligible. That's the observational constraint.
Where is it? Does that come from?
Amendola, Gordon, Wands, and Sasaki. It's the only one that constrains these fully correlated perturbations.
Does it come from Gaussianity or the isocurvature?
From the isocurvature.
One in the space of, the 19th.
But in general, I think Matthew is right that there's still a hell of a lot of theoretical freedom.
Oh, yeah.
Since we haven't identified the source of dark matter, dark energy, inflation, or anything.
Oh, yeah.
But aren't we in better shape than other investigations beyond the standard model, which don't have any data at all? I mean,
just need more data. Yeah,
so I feel that. So that I can understand. So your model predicts three deviations from what I would call the standard.
Well, allows
the isocurvature perturbations, non-Gaussianity,
yes,
and also a dark matter candidate other than the axion or lips that people usually
I'm not sure what you mean, but it's important that any...
I know if it comes irrelevant today, but so suppose the sigma decays.
Into dark matter.
Well, it has to decay directly into dark matter.
Dark matter could be a component of its decay, and that is consistent with observation.
Right, but if I think about the weakly interacting mass of particles, which are presumably produced with the electroweak phase transition,
yeah.
The density at any given point in space depends only on the temperature.
Yeah.
Then I would be back to adiabatic perturbation.
Not if they freeze out before the curvatron decays. In that case, they would actually produce an isocurvature perturbation bigger than that, and it would be ruled out.
So the curvatron has to...
It has to decay kind of early enough, you know.
Unless you have late inflation, that's pretty late, right? I mean, these things don't decouple until 100 MeV or something.
Yeah, but we're not talking about inflation. We're talking about when the curvatron decays, which could be much, much later than the end of inflation.
But it's pretty weakly coupled for that long, right?
But it would have to decay.
It doesn't need to start it oscillating until long after inflation.
But it does. It would have to decay into something other than a weakly interacting mass of particle. Or if it decayed into a weakly interacting mass of particle, then it would be some new component of dark matter.
Yes.
Okay, let's thank the speaker.